We are continuing today in our sermon series on the life of David. We have contended all along that David's life and the Bible's record of it in 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings, and through a number of Psalms, is not simply historical phenomena associated with a random figure, as we might consider any person that's lived and things associated with their past, but instead is something of a window by which we can view the reality of God's lordship or God's kingdom. We said that Israel, the initial way that God began to reestablish his rule and kingship over the world, is something like a pilot series on TV, like a mini-series, by which we are able initially to view what God is intending to do, to establish a place where he is the ruler, the Lord, where his will is obeyed, and where all of the benefits that come with having God as your king are experienced. Forgiveness, for instance, joy, peace, prosperity, and all of these things are meant to be seen in miniature ways in Israel. And of course, as we see in the Bible, far beyond them. Today we're continuing in studying David's life, but not through 1 and 2 Samuel, rather through Psalm 52. Perhaps you remember that a couple weeks ago we looked at 1 Samuel 18, which I said is really something of a summary for the second half of 1 Samuel. So in chapter 16, David is anointed to be the king. In chapter 17, David, his first act as the new chosen of God to be Israel's Messiah, that is the anointed one, to be her Christ, the Greek word for Messiah, to be the leader, God's representative, is to crush God's enemy, Goliath. And now, 1 Samuel begins the transition with a time which is pivotal in David's life, where he is anointed to be the king. However, Saul is still enthroned. He's still acting as the king. And for about 10 years, David becomes a political refugee, fleeing from Saul's rage and murderous intent, living in the hills of Judea and in foreign countries, as an exile, really seeking to save his own life. And then in 2 Samuel, we pick up with David being installed as king. What we want to do for the next month or so is to look at different songs that David composed during this time period in his life, which really will give us a vantage point to see deeply into the way in which David understood a number of experiences. And Psalm 52 is just such a song. So we'll pick up with Psalm 52. I will read it. And then today, really, what I'm going to do is to tell you the story of Nob, which is the backdrop for this psalm, and then to look at Psalm 52. And finally, we'll make a few concluding observations. So first, then, God's Word, Psalm 52. And I'll be reading the small all-caps letters that are before the psalm, which is called the superscription. And a couple things to note about that. One, that this gives the context back to the psalm. Two, this word maskil is also mentioned in Psalm 47:7. And probably that's a liturgical word. It might just mean song. And then finally, you'll notice the word salah, which is in italics, and it's off to the right of the psalm. We believe that that's a note for pause. It's a musical note, and so not read. All right, then, starting off, Psalm 52. As it's addressed. To the choir master, and the skill of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul, David has come to the house of Ahimelech. Why do you boast, O mighty man? The steadfast love of God endures all the day. Your tongue plots destruction like a sharp razor, you worker of deceit. You love evil more than good and lying more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. But God will break you down forever. He will snatch and tear you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, See the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and sought refuge in his own destruction. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. I will thank you forever because you have done it. I will wait for your name, for it is good in the presence of the godly. The grass withers and the flower falls.
But the word of the Lord remains forever.
Amen. Starting off then with the backdrop of this story, the story of this psalm, the story of Nob. In order to understand what David's written here, we must understand something of the context in which he composed it. And we pick up in that context in 1 Samuel chapter 21 and then 22. If you're handy with your Bible, go ahead and turn there and put your finger or thumb or something like that in the Psalm 52. We start with the story of Nob, really on the heels of another story. It's a story we've looked at already where David has made a pact with Jonathan, Saul's son. Jonathan has pledged his fidelity to David, that he will always be his friend, that he will watch out for him. And in this context, Jonathan is warning David about his father's murderous intent. Perhaps you remember Jonathan has interceded already for David. There's some confusion over whether or not Saul, who's already shown remorse, will continue on with his desire to destroy David. And therefore, at a special appointed feast, Jonathan goes before Saul, and it's determined that Saul is in fact still after David. They've arranged already a meeting, and Jonathan and David meet out in the field, and Jonathan relays to his friend through tears that his father is after David. In fact, that he's seeking right now his life. You can imagine David's angst, and immediately David flees from right then and there. He doesn't return home. He doesn't say goodbye to his wife. He takes only what he has, which is really nothing, no provisions with him, and he seeks refuge. He flees. Several of David's close companions, his men, perhaps are alerted or already there waiting with him, and they accompany him. David and these companions leave Gibeah, where Saul's station is set up, and they flee, and the first place they go to on their way out is a small city called Nob. Nob is several miles from Gibeah, and it's a couple miles from Jerusalem. So it's an interesting city in that it's sort of a midway point, an hour or two outside of two major cities. And Nob is on a ridge so that it overlooks Jerusalem. It's thought to be the first place that you can actually see Jerusalem. It's a small city, probably had a couple hundred people in it at this time. And it's a city which is something of a commune. It's a place where priests would go to probably get away from Jerusalem. And it's a place where they've set up to sacrifice to God, living together, worshiping God. And it's a place of refuge, but also with a close proximity to major venues. Now, it seems that this is a place that David has been to frequently. And in fact, David is well familiar with the head priest, the elder in charge of that area, Ahimelech. So David first goes to Nob seeking refuge, seeking provisions, seeking to meet with God. And as he does so, he leaves his party, small group, behind and enters Nob alone. And Ahimelech greets David, and immediately he is able to discern something is the matter. So he asks David, "Why are you alone?" He sees certainly that David is making haste and that he's not accompanied with perhaps his troops as is normal. And David now in chapter 21 gives Ahimelech something of what we might call a weak excuse, right? He says, "Well, I'm in this urgent business for the king, and I didn't have time to get my provisions, sword, food, clothing, any of this stuff. And also, don't tell anyone about it because it's a big secret. It's a covert mission." Ahimelech, perhaps a little bit suspicious, nonetheless obliges David, helps him as much as he's able. Gives him the sacred bread there meant for sacrifice to God, to David and his men, and in fact even gives him Goliath's sword, something of a relic which must have been kept there in the shrine. Wishes him well. They meet with God together. And it seems that all is really going according to plan. David is escaping well. But then, in verse 7 of chapter 21 in 1 Samuel, we hear with something of an ominous note, a hitch. Now there was a certain man of the servants of Saul who was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg, the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. Now, thus far in the Bible, we've never heard of Doeg before, but even his name to me has a bad ring to it, doesn't it? And he's an Edomite. He's not an Israelite. He comes from the enemies of God's people. He's a hired hand. He's in charge of Saul's herds. He's a lackey. And what we see as the story progresses, skipping about a chapter and a half, is that this figure, Doeg, will play a prominent role in Nob's future. We catch up with he and with Saul no longer at Nob, but now at Gilead, where Saul is beginning to berate his men. He's angry that his son Jonathan has teamed up with David and pledged fidelity to him. He's angry that all his leads for David's life have grown cold. He's hot with rage, this homicidal mania that often consumes him. And so he's berating his men. Have all of my men teamed up with David, the son of Jesse? Will David do what I will do for you? Will he give you houses and fields and donkeys, great riches? Will no one help me to capture my enemy? With this barrage of questions, there's an inevitable silence. But then, at just the right moment, Doeg shares what must have been a tasty morsel that he's been saving up for some time. He says to Saul, I saw David fleeing. I saw him at Nob. And what's more, Ahimelech, the priest at Nob, aided David. He abetted him. He helped him. As you can imagine, Saul goes berserk. He's livid. And so he says, right now, summon the priests at Nob. Get them here before me. And we see in chapter 22 something of Saul's interrogation, starting off in verse 12. Hear now, son of Ahiatub. And he says, Ahimelech says, here I am, my lord. Saul says to him, why have you conspired against me, that you and the son of Jesse have given him bread and a sword and inquired of God for him? And to get today he's risen against me to lie in wait? Ahimelech, certainly unaware of these things and befuddled, he answers the king, who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's own son-in-law, captain over the bodyguard, honored over your house? Is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all of the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of this, much or little. But Saul will hear nothing of it. He's furious. And he orders that Ahimelech and all of the priests at Nob be put to death for their treasonous rebellion against his rule. The men there around Saul, certainly understanding something of the enormity of the events that are transpiring, they refuse the king's orders to kill these priests of the Lord. And so Saul turns to Doeg, the trenchman. He says that he ought to strike down these priests, and we pick up in verse 18. And he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child and infant, ox and donkey, sheep, he put to the sword. Doeg's hand is the one that slaughters the whole of this small, peaceful city and 85 priests of Yahweh. Only one man escapes, Ahimelech's son, who will now flee to David seeking refuge and protection, who will be for decades now David's priest, something of a religious advisor at his right hand. And he brings the news to David about this awful slaughter and what's happened and about what Doeg, this Edomite, has done. And you can imagine upon hearing the news, a wash of grief and of exceeding sorrow comes over David. He's beside himself, feeling guilty and horrible and righteously furious at what has occurred and what Doeg and Saul have perpetrated. And that is the context for which he writes this song, now known as Psalm 52. In Psalm 52, David first begins an indictment against Doeg, against all of the wicked on the earth. He asks a question to open. Why do you boast of evil, O mighty man? The idea here is not pomp necessarily in the boasting, but in a self-satisfaction that comes from being clever, from having outwitted Doeg and others like him, feel pride and haughtiness at what they've been able to do. They feel as though they're mighty men. But David, he knows otherwise. He says that God's steadfast love endures all the day. It's certainly in contrast here to the haughtiness, the boasting that occurs with people who think they're mighty, who think that they have power in their hand to do awful things like Doeg had done. But David understands something unseen, a reality, not comprehended by such persons. That God's steadfast love, even amidst awful things such as this, endures all day. Now he continues this indictment of the wicked, focusing especially on the way in which Doeg, through this deceit that he has spun to Saul, has wreaked harm. Your tongue plots destruction. It's like a sharp razor. It causes great harm and hurt. He's used deceit and lying to perpetrate this thing. He loves evil more than good, speaking lying things rather than what is right. He loves words that devour. David sees what Doeg has done. He's furious. He condemns him in his lying words, the report that he has given to Saul. But David's answer to these awful events that have occurred isn't just to be found in condemning the wicked and decrying what has occurred. Instead, this psalm is primarily about God's response. What God will do in the face of such tragedy, such oppression and injustice. It's a response that God has to more than the story of Nob, but to all of the wickedness and evil and injustice that occurs in this world. Captured here in David's song. As often David expresses his deepest emotions in song. What he says in verse, starting in verse 5, is the way in which God will reply to the evil of this world. Really, this is David's answer. Something that gives him real comfort in the face of a world which is seemingly out of control and horrible, filled with tragedy. He says this, God will break you down forever. God's anger and his judgment upon the wicked extend beyond this life. The forever here is paralleled with what we see in verse 9, the way in which God's people enjoy his love forever. And God's love for the world and for truth and for righteousness means that he will not condone or allow wickedness to go unpunished. We often, in our world, certainly this is true for me, for our family, we insulate ourselves to much of the tragedy, much of the difficulty, much of the real hardship in life. We live in a beautiful place that's sunny all the time, in nice homes, with good jobs, with recreations and families and friends and good bagels at church and all this kind of thing, right? And we understand or experience, most of us, very little of the real hardship and sorrow that exists in this world. David was not a foreigner to that, though. In fact, over these next 10 years, as he flees from cave to cave, as a political refugee, he will experience a great deal of hardship, of angst. And right now he experiences the horror of having seen a village of priests and peaceful peoples mowed down. And what he says, as a result of God's love enduring, is that God will do something. Christianity affirms, this worldview that we believe from the Bible affirms that there really is right and wrong in the world. Morality is established. Therefore, our actions have meaning. And that God is the judge of all the earth. And he will do right. He will put things in their place. He will make wrongs right. The fact that because of God's love, because of his character and who he is, he cares about what's done in the world. And that deeds like Doeg has done are evil. And they must be met with punishment. So David now has confidence looking at who God is. He says, he will break you down forever. And now what is a very vivid and frightful depiction of the way in which God will break down his enemies, those who have done evil here on earth. He will snatch you and tear you from your tent. These are by and large tent-dwelling people. What David's saying is he will snatch you from your home. He will find you out, even though you think you are mighty. I was a Boy Scout growing up, and I went to Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico. One of the things we did is we had, there's this big kind of telephone pole, maybe 60 feet up in the air, and we were taught to climb it with, you know, you put the spikes in your boots and you use the belt, like you see with the telephone people, this kind of thing. And when the demonstrator was showing us how to do this, he got up to the top, and you've got a belay rope. So people are holding you in a harness with a rope down below. And he had five or six of us teenagers hold on to the one side of the rope so that if he fell, well, then he wouldn't fall too hard. But he had it rigged. He understood that his body weight jumping off the top would be way too much for us to hold. And so when he was at the top, he said, okay, now get a really good hold and make sure you're all established so that if something happens, you can catch me. So we're all dug in. We've got our knees bent. We're ready, right? And he jumps off the top. And instantly, we're picked up in the air and just thrown about 10 feet before he grabs on. And that's what I think of when I hear, God will snatch you. You think you're in the safety of your home, but God has his hand around your ankle. And you're not nearly as mighty as you imagine, as David vividly now describes the onslaught of God's judgment. And he rips the wicked from their home in a terrifying fashion. He says here that God will uproot them from the land of the living. It's the beginning of a metaphor, a picture that this psalm gives us of people as trees. People are often compared to trees in the Bible. And the wicked here are seen as a tree that might be comparable to, say, a tumbleweed in the desert. Their root system, though they might feel established, is shallow and is at risk. And God now easily rips and tears and uproots them. In contrast to what David will describe himself as a green olive tree bearing fruit, flourishing. God's response to evil, such as Doeg has done, such as Saul has done, such as the evil that exists far and wide in our world, is anger and is hostility. What we see in this psalm is that David, his answer to the real evil that exists in the world, is the reality that God is judge and that he will punish. The psalm continues as we hear about the way in which people respond to what God has done, in particular, the way God's people respond. The first thing they do is they fear. The idea of the fear of God in the Old Testament is not so much trembling here as much as reverence, awe, recognition. In response to the way in which God will judge and punish his enemies, God's people stand up, they take notice, they are humbled, and they are certainly reverential of God's power and might displayed in the destruction of his enemies. And what's more, not only will they fear, But it says here that they will mock. They shall laugh at him, saying, see, there's a pedagogical purpose. They learn something. See, look at the man who would not make God his refuge, who trusted in the abundance of his riches. Doeg was here motivated by Saul's pledge of money and prosperity for those who would help him. And the righteous together, they're able to say, as they look at what's happened, the end to evil, this was not the way to live. Look what occurs to those who trusted in their money, who lived with deceit. And they're able actually now to join in as they are vindicated openly and as God's justice is exacted. They're able to join in with the victory that God accomplishes.